Greetings, Earth explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Greetings, Earth explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State, where it's clear and crisp outside. My AccuWindow forecast says no rain today. The solar wind is blazing at 619.9 kilometers per second, but there are still no sunspots. Earth is inside a coronal hole in the sun, yet there have been no reports of aurora borealis. Strange how these new instruments placed by the Themis Project a year ago are revealing that there is little correlation between the solar wind and northern lights. Perhaps there is another source for the ionic ribbons we see in the night sky. Discovered just yesterday, small asteroid 2007 EZ7 will fly past Earth tonight at a distance of only 100,000 miles. Using an ephemeris from the Minor Planet Center, advanced amateur astronomers may be able to... P7 would attract minimal attention. Even if it hit Earth, the result would be little more than a bright fireball and a sprinkling of meteorites across some uninhabited stretch of our planet. But 2000 EZ7 may prove to be more interesting, however. Rumor has it, it has a second space rock, provisionally named BJ19377. It's following in a similar orbit and will soon make its own close approach. Could this be a twin asteroid flyby? Stay tuned for updates. A star that died 340,000 years ago has provided fresh evidence that the energetic particles known as cosmic rays are being fired out by supernova. Now, Italian researchers Marco Salvati of Arcetri Astrophysical Observatory in Florence and Bruno Saccio of the National Institute for Astrophysics in Palermo suggested that an ancient supernova, which created the Gemini pulsar, is responsible for a slight excess in cosmic rays from one part of the sky. And we thought those only came from the sun. Also, they found clay-encrusted boulders recently on Mars, and they're evidence of ancient and perhaps once habitable lakes, a new study finds. A spectrometer on MRO, called CRISM, discovered that the rocks are covered by layers of fine sediment and clay, which forms through prolonged contact with water. This points to conditions in early Mars history that were really quite different, remarkably so, from what we see today. The first lake probably lasted for thousands of years before drying up. If we were looking on Earth for an environment that preserves signatures related to habitability, this is one of the kinds of environments we would target. It seems that liquid water in our own solar system isn't as rare as once thought. Coming up on the 16th, we have Miriam Delicato coming on the program. She is going to discuss her new book and her contact with the tall blonde ETs. The messages are amazing, so don't miss this one. This week we have a special treat for you. We have the world explorer Tom Carey on board with us. Tom became interested in UFOs while in high school and rekindled that interest when he became the MUFON State Section Director for Southeastern Pennsylvania in 1986. Since 1991, Tom's research has focused solely on the so-called Roswell incident and the alleged retrieval and cover-up by the U.S. government of an alien spaceship and crew that crashed near the town of Roswell, New Mexico, in July of 1947. His portrait appears in the Hall of Fame at the International UFO Museum and Research Center in Roswell, New Mexico, for his continuing contributions to our understanding of the Roswell events of 1947. With Don Schmidt, Tom was the investigative consultant for the highly acclaimed and top-rated 2002 Sci-Fi Channel documentary, The Roswell Crash, Startling New Evidence. We're in luck tonight because we have not only Tom Carey on the air with us, we also have Don Schmidt. Welcome, both of you. How are you?
Good evening. Nice to be with you.
Oh, this is a great pleasure for us. Many of our listeners listen live, and because we are webcast instead of radiocast, our listeners are rather unique in that they're sitting there with their computers and a credit card in their hands. So it's kind of interesting, the responses we get. Also, we take live phone calls, so I'll give those numbers out now, and we'll make the numbers live all night. In the U.S. and Canada, our toll-free number is 888-228-4494. And Canada has its own toll-free, 877-489-6350. And anywhere else on planet, off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-776-5154. And also, we will even take Skype, so if you want to reach us that way, it's BBS Radio. And if you're using PalTalk, it's BBSRadio_com. It is a great pleasure to have you both here. I can tell you, I've spoken to literally thousands of people about the subject of UFOs, and some people, like me, they asked me, do you believe in UFOs? Like it was some sort of religion or something. I simply asked them if they believe we are alone in the universe, and we kind of reach this stalemate of deer in the headlight looks. So how did you guys go from enthusiasts to actual researchers in this field?
Well, this is Tom. I'll go first. I was interested as a high school student in UFOs. I don't know why it caught my attention, but it was something that I found interesting, other life in the universe. And even when I was in graduate school, I always belonged to the local, whatever the local UFO group was. I always belonged. And when the 1980 book, The Roswell Incident, came out, I was hooked on that particular aspect of the UFO phenomenon, the crash saucers, because here we're dealing with not just lights in the sky and, geez, what was it? Did you see that? We're dealing with the potential for physical evidence, artifacts in the form of wreckage and perhaps bodies. That's what interested me the most. It was something potentially tangible rather than something ephemeral that might have passed across your vision and was gone. So that's how I got interested. And in 1991, I had subscribed to the International UFO Reporter, which was published by the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies in Chicago. Don Schmidt and Kevin Randall were at that time reinvestigating the Roswell incident. They were bringing new energy to the field, reopening the case. And one aspect of the case was the archaeologist from the University of Pennsylvania that allegedly stumbled upon the crashed craft. At that time, I lived in Philadelphia, and these archaeologists were from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, so I thought, well, geez, maybe I can investigate that aspect of the case. And that's how I hooked up with Randall and Schmidt. And since 1998, Don and I have been continuing a proactive investigation of the Roswell case, because we want to get every last witness that we can to the event, because when they are gone, they take their stories with them, and they will be unavailable to us. So that's what we are doing. Our mandate is to track down every last witness that we can while still looking for physical evidence. That's still number one on our list, is searching for physical evidence. And until the we've exhausted every avenue, we are on the case.
Well, that sounds very dedicated. Don, how did you go from enthusiast to active investigator? It takes a lot of sacrifice, time, and dedication, and going through a lot of disappointment and dead ends and even blocked access. So what kept you going, Don?
Oh, no doubt. And just even by your mentioning, the obstacle course that we are often drawn through, if it was so simple as to just openly present itself without any shadow of a doubt, I'd wonder if we were going in the right direction. I think it's because it has been such a lifelong devotion, advocation, in determining the truth to what happened back in 1947. It quickly went from an enthusiasm. I mean, after all, I mean, what young man doesn't grow up, what young woman doesn't grow up as far as with, some type of a fascination with outer space, whether, becoming an astronaut or just dealing with what we clearly, are convinced is the biggest story of the millennium. I think one of the big, mysteries in all this is why the press just flatly refuses to look into something which, is probably the biggest story they would ever look into.
Right, right. One of the things that fascinated me about the case, even as an enthusiast, even, as a person who has a day job and is, really waiting for that shoe to drop, for that one piece of irrefutable evidence to hit the mainstream news, it seemed like Roswell had the most hope, and I think it did for most people. But what was kind of interesting is, at least from my standpoint, is that the crash occurred in 1947, and we're still not exactly sure which day, maybe. But it seemed like the government swooped in with vacuum cleaners and picked up every last nut, bolt, screw, wire, piece of metal that they could find, and then either employed or intimidated all the witnesses to where it made it even more mysterious. So with all the evidence and photographs out there, how did you become solely focused on the Roswell case?
Well, for the very reasons you have just cited, unlike just about, you know, every other UFO case, we don't have to, you know, wait for some White House landing. We don't have to wait for some spectacular, you know, multi-witness UFO event to bring this, you know, to the, you know, the public's attention. It's something that we can point to Washington, D.C. and say, you have the evidence. You have the documentation. We're dealing now on an earthly plane. We're dealing with people here who are not infallible. We're dealing with people that have come out and given us statement after statement, up to even deathbed testimony. You know, not just creating a belief on our part, but a conviction.
Right.
I can't emphasize enough that I was a skeptic on the possibility that the government could, you know, contain, you know, and keep something of this magnitude a secret after all that time. I mean, after all, the government typically is leaking like a sieve when it comes
yeah.
to secret information.
Right.
And then I realized very early into the investigation that it has been leaking out, that there have been witnesses such as the late Major Jesse Marcel, who was the intelligence officer at Roswell back at that time, and for all their failed efforts to bring this to the public attention, again, the media was turning a deaf ear, a blind eye. They weren't, they acted as though they were complicit in the cover-up. And I think that's what one of the convictions we have also come to, you know, the government media complex, in that basically, you know, they work together. They work in tandem to essentially, brainwash and condition and indoctrinate the people, the public, as to what we accept and hold as the truth. And I'm sorry, Roswell has 4 official explanations. And the only witnesses we have to an explanation are the fact that it was indeed the recovery of a flying saucer. Not a weather balloon, not wooden crash dummies, not a secret project, but indeed that it was the actual recovery of a ship and its crew from another planet.
Well, yeah, I feel that exact same way. Any good investigator is going to be a skeptic. I mean, you can't just walk into it, you know, believing that everything is true. You have to question people. You have to validate evidence and testimony and cross-correlate testimonies and timelines. You know, it's like being almost like a criminal investigator, except in this case, it appears to be the government that has committed the crime. Even though there are much better documented cases and with sometimes thousands of witnesses and film clips, what has made Roswell a household word known around the world? What is it about this case that gives it its legs?
That's a good question. We get it all the time. And you're right. There are cases, let's say, you know, the Phoenix Lights, the recent cases in Stephenville, Texas, where you have thousands of witnesses, apparently, videotape. You know, to me, it looks like something's really going on there. But those cases have had their run, and you know, nothing seems to come of them. And the reason I believe that Roswell has become the, as Don likes to call it, the granddaddy of all UFO cases, is that there were a lot of witnesses. There were military witnesses, maybe not thousands, but certainly many. Military witnesses, civilian witnesses. There were attempts at suppression. There were death threats. You have the possibility, the promise. I will use the term the promise of physical evidence, where your lights in the sky, let's call them, cases don't give you the promise of physical evidence. Photographs can be hoaxed. Videotapes and films, even though some of them look fairly good to me, there's always that thought in the back of your mind, well, maybe, you know, maybe it really is something else other than a UFO. Maybe it is a government flare or something like that, although I don't believe that. That's still back there. But Roswell just has so many elements to it where you, to me, I know I'm as excited today as I was the very first day that I became involved on this case. I'm as excited to find a new witness today as I was 10, 15 years ago. Well, now, the case has become worldwide because of television. It's become known. It's been broadcast on commercial TV, cable TV, certainly. And if you go to the Roswell Museum, they have a world map. And they have a little red pin where they put on the map where someone comes from to visit the museum. And they have these little red pins sticking in the museum wall map from all over the world, literally. People have come there.
Yeah.
How many? 150 countries?
150 countries.
That's amazing. I'm so glad to hear you say that you're as excited today about a new witness coming forth and giving some little piece of evidence that makes the puzzle more clear. I mean, we've all read about this incident, but have any witnesses come forth lately that actually pinpoint the crash, or is an extrapolation of decomposed alien bodies the best evidence we have for exactly when the crash occurred?
No, and in fact, and Tom has been especially very ardent as far as coming up with new witnesses in the last year. One, for example, would be Earl Fulford, who was actually part of the recovery team at the debris field. So for the first time, we actually have someone from the military who broke his security oath and acknowledged to us that, yes, indeed, he was out there, and they recovered pieces that were in no way conventional. They were far from being balloon parts, and that was even aware of other aspects of the case. In fact, as far as even a flatbed truck that went out to the site and came back with some cargo.
Wow.
So that's the type of witnesses that we're getting more and more, as even Sheila Winhall, as far as when the Air Force threw Colonel Richard Weaver in September of 1994 when they had the Mogul Balloon Press Conference at the Pentagon. And they absolved all Air Force personnel of security oaths regarding this case. And that's been a tremendous assistance.
Well, that's awesome. I think we have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
My name is Yvonne, and I'm calling from Dayton, Ohio.
Oh, how are you?
Welcome to the program. I'm fine. Actually, I had a couple questions concerning the North Pole Expedition. I know that's not exactly the theme, but can I ask those to Dr. Agnew?
About the expedition?
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll take one quick question about it, but we kind of like to stay focused on the subject at hand if we can.
Okay. It's a quick question. I've been monitoring, like, what you were doing lately, and I was just wondering what exact information you have concerning those coordinates and where do they come from, so 84.4 north and 141 east. I mean, the whole project is very fascinating, and I was just curious what exact information you've got.
Well, we don't have much exact evidence. There are a lot of anomalies that have happened. and subsequently raise more questions for which we do not have answers, and that's why we want to do an expedition with scientists so that we can gather the data and try to evaluate a theory which seems to live on over millennia, and that is that the Earth might in fact be hollow. So we're just going to go see. We're not saying the Earth is hollow, but gee, wouldn't it be nice to discover something new?
In fact, I think that's fascinating.
Well, I think it is too, and that's why we keep pushing for to get it completed, and hopefully in 2009 we'll get this thing done. I think we will, now that we've got a good producer online. All right, Stephen, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Let me ask you one other question. We were talking about threat of retribution going away, at least as far as for government employees and government witnesses, and that has allowed some of them to come forward and actually tell their story. How many Air Force explanations have there been for the Roswell incident?
Correct me if I'm wrong, Don, but I think there have been four.
Four, and we believe they're working on a fifth.
The first one was the correct one. The headline of July the 8th, 1947, where the Air Force announced the recovery of a flying saucer near Roswell. That was correct. Within hours, they changed it to the weather balloon explanation. Had they chosen a different explanation, and I think Don will agree with me on this, that it could have been an experimental fighter plane, an experimental rocket, something like that, we wouldn't be talking about the Roswell case tonight. But they chose, of all things, a weather balloon, and have asked us to believe that our elite military unit at the time, in 1947, the 509th Bomb Group, this was the outfit that dropped the two atomic bombs to end World War II, had somehow misidentified a common balsa wood, rubber, and tinfoil weather balloon for an interstellar spacecraft. That's what they want us to believe. So that was the second explanation. The third was the takeoff on that, the high-altitude Project Mogul balloon device, which they attempted to listen in on expected atomic detonations by the Soviet Union. But the problem there was while the project was top secret, Project Mogul, the balloons and the tinfoil radar targets were off-the-shelf common items that no six-year-old would misidentify. So that's the problem with that explanation. And the fourth explanation was the, I like to call the dummies from the sky explanation, the mannequins, the dime store mannequins that they used to try to explain away the reports of the little alien bodies that were alleged to have been recovered at the Roswell crash. So those are the four main ones. And Don and I, in counting up our witnesses, there is no living or dead credible witness to a balloon event on the Foster Ranch. There is no witness, not one, to a balloon event on the Foster Ranch at this period in 1947. So, but the Air Force continues to stand by that story.
Well, you know, it's not like you can just pick up the phone and dial information and get the Air Force, and you can get somebody on the phone that knows something official that they're going to tell you. Some spokesman is going to come out and by public demand or political pressure, or someone in Washington who's trying to get reelected in New Mexico might say, would you go out and make a statement just to kind of get the camera lights to go out on this one? And so they just dig a hole deeper and deeper. That's what it appears to me to be.
Well, most typically, if you were to contact any Air Force base or even the Pentagon itself, they would refer you to the National Archives, that all the Project Blue Book files were declassified in 1977, and they washed their hands of the entire UFO investigation in December of 1969. So officially, the United States government has no further interest in the subject of UFOs. And yet we know that there were other projects that went on beyond Blue Book and that they are still very actively involved. It's just
It doesn't sound to me like public demand alone would push something like that. I think we have one more caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
This is Lyle from Indianapolis, Indiana.
Hi, Lyle. Welcome to the program.
Good evening to you and to your guests. One thing that I wanted to say was the whole thing about the Roswell case is that the military had said that they had recovered a UFO and then tried to change it. Now, and that's the thing about it. You have a military who is supposed to be in the business of defending your country, and for them to not be able to tell a balloon from a UFO is the ludicrous point, and that's why I think it's gone along and has had legs, as you call it, is because of that fact.
Oh, yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, and I think that our guests will say, let's see, Tom, what's your take on that? Do you think that that's right, that, here is the military, they're here to defend us, and oops, they can't tell the difference between a UFO and a weather balloon?
Well, the military, over and above that, they don't want to admit that they're not in control, especially the Air Force, that they're not in control of our airspace. Their mission, the Air Force's mission, is to control and protect us by controlling our airspace. And to admit the reality of UFOs, and by UFOs I don't mean something that is natural that we just briefly can't identify, but something from somewhere else that was constructed artificially that they can't control the airspace, tacitly are admitting failure of their mission. So I think that's a large part of it. The other part of it is that there were logical reasons back in 1947, although I don't agree with their methods, for trying to contain this story. But what happens to secrets and to cover-ups is they get a life of their own. They start, years later you say, oh, why is it still covered up? And, it's always been covered up, so we'll just continue to cover it up. I think that's also an element.
I think another part of it is that basically if you came out and admitted that there were other beings from other planets, it may have caused chaos in our society, because those who would want to rule over us, now you have somebody else that has a little more power and can do a little bit more than our government. And that probably would have caused issues also. But
well, now you have two issues here. One is, okay, the Brookings Institution would say, oh, gee, if intelligent life does exist elsewhere in the universe, and by golly, they've been here to see us, is that going to cause widespread panic and chaos? That's one. And the second is that the Air Force sees anything that can make a left-hand turn at 10,000 miles an hour a clear and present danger. So these are two forces at work here that are doing a really good job of vacuuming up all the evidence that this stuff exists in our country. Am I right, Don?
Well, as Tom already pointed out, it still comes down to control. Anyone who would like to believe that any of our elected officials actually think of the general public, the electorate, over their own careers, I'd like to meet this individual. The principal existence is to get reelected.
Sure.
Just imagine any elected official, imagine the president himself going before the American people and saying that we are being visited. We're not alone. There is life from another planet visiting our own. It's able to fly through our airspace with total impunity. We don't know where they're from, who they are, or what they want. But trust us, and please vote for me come next election.
Well, Okay, I can go along with that, except that it seems 47% of the population of the United States doesn't just believe in UFOs, they've seen one. The ratio is much higher for those that actually believe in them. As the last couple presidents that were elected with less than 47% of the vote.
Yes.
So it would seem if someone would come forth and say, you know, I will bring full disclosure to bear.
50% of the people standing behind them. I agree. In fact, at times, the Gallup poll has even been higher than 50%.
Yeah.
But we still maintain that it's a cover-up of ignorance, that they still don't have all the answers. So in other words, what can they possibly announce? What can they finally admit to? And we still believe one of the deep, dark secrets, especially about Roswell, is the fact that they resorted to physical threats and maybe carried out some of that physicality back in 1947. They threatened parents. They threatened children over this incident. And who's going to be held accountable for that? And I think it's one of the main reasons, as we sit here this evening, that it's simply a running out the clock, stalling for time. The idea is that as the final witnesses pass on, it then becomes cover-up complete. And there's no one left to, you know, press any charges or point any fingers or, you know, make any claims against, you know, the government.
Well, Lyle, what do you think? If they come clean, if they admit everything and then put all the evidence on the table, and I think there's hardly a man, woman, or child that believes that the U.S. doesn't have some kind of advanced technology from another world. If they came clean, Lyle, would you be willing to wipe the slate clean and not put anybody in jail for the last 53 or 60 years of cover-up?
For those who are recently in it, I would be happy to. Those who are further back and covered up, I would be tempted to take some action against. And let me tell you why. I don't think our government will come clean and let us know. What I think is going to happen is they're going to make their presence known, and at that point, it's there. I don't think our government has carried forth with the lie for too long, and I think they've deliberately done it, and there's really no way out for them. But just to give them carte blanche, you know, I'd hate to give somebody who probably did kill somebody immunity and let them walk for, you know, killing somebody. And you could just look at the UFO history, and there have been some mysterious deaths of some of the researchers. And, you know, I feel that that's a part of the government or a part of a secret government that's operating, and I don't feel that they should get off for that.
Well, I have a tendency to agree with you, Lyle. I wouldn't let someone off for doing violence against someone else to cover
it up. The government is also taking a big risk here. For 60 years, they've been telling us that there's no such thing as UFOs, let's use that term, meaning in our lexicon, a spaceship. They've been telling us there's no such thing. They're taking a big chance because one, in fact, could land on the White House lawn tomorrow morning. You know what I mean? That would put the lie to everything.
Well, you know, I'll have to say, there had been a recent flyover, I think within the last few years, of Washington again. But my whole thing is, they're not going to come clean. Even if we said, okay, what are you going to give them immunity to? Everything that they did? And like I said, I don't want to give anybody, any murderers, a walk. But I had another question for you. Has there been any identification of the aliens, alien bodies that were recovered? And do they match any of the known alien types that are commonly out there in the UFO field?
Well, even to digress just for a moment, I think one of the things that especially continues to excite both Tom and myself about the case is that we're talking about you know, virgin territory. You know, today when we hear about a report of an unknown, you know, many of us, if not most of us, immediately assume it's some new state-of-the-art, you know, technological advancement, you know, from our own military. But back in 47, you know, for all the descriptions, for everything that was being reported in that summer of 1947, this was clearly something advanced, something that just completely outmaneuvered, outperformed anything we had in the air. And for some of the skeptics who suggested that the witnesses were just UFO buffs back in 1947, well, there were no UFO books back at that time. I mean, the common depiction in science fiction, whether it was Flash Gordon or Buck Rogers and that like, were that aliens came in rocket ships and that they looked, you know, typically like monsters, or they looked human in appearance. So Roswell, you know, was an awakening. It was, you know, it was where the floodgates of realization that we were indeed not alone. We not only were being visited, but my God, one dropped right in our laps, and we don't have any answers.
Well,
you ask about the depiction of the bodies. Yes, they are. They are, you know, the classic, you know, very short statured, the humanoid type with the larger disproportionate head, the diminutive nose, ear, and mouth, the larger almond-shaped eyes, and the slender, more spindly body. And there, too, Roswell being the predecessor to everything that we've learned since, it would, again, suggest that just like Hollywood tends to copy reality, well, the UFO field has then reflected what happened back in 1947.
Well, it does seem kind of strange that the best evidence that we have has been made into cinematography and made into feature films, and that's really the closest contact the general public around the world has had with any kind of alien technology. The Air Force has had so many different official denials that we, the people, are nearly 100% sure they don't have a clue what went on out there in New Mexico. Or if they do, it's in some warehouse somewhere, and a very, very small faction inside the Air Force really knows what went on out there.
I do want to make a correction. Stephensville, Texas was not the, you know, you have the modern stuff, but there was something in the early 1800s that occurred, well, I think it was the late 1800s, and that story is in Alien Agenda by Jim Mars, where he talks
about Aurora, Texas.
Yeah, where yes, there was a ship that crashed and the pilot also, and they did say that the government did come in there and retrieve it. So you're looking at, you're saying that our government has had this technology for recovered technology for a long time, and so they've been able to work with it, and we've got some, I think we've gotten some advancements from it, and I think that, you know, they're at the point where they can use a part, or have figured out a part of it to create ships that we have not seen yet, or many people have seen yet. I think some of the UFOs that are being seen are ours, but I think there are some that aren't ours.
Lyle, have you ever seen an off-world vehicle of your own?
Yes, on several occasions. Up until my 30s, I used to see them quite a bit. One time I went from Indianapolis to Kokomo. I worked in Kokomo, and I would see a ship. I couldn't tell the dimensions of it because it was ways away, but it was hovering, and it stayed in that position for at least 5 minutes. And about the time I got close to it is the time that it took off or moved off. So I've seen different types. I've seen the I've seen the blip type. Okay. And sorry about
that. I get that all the time, Lyle. Don't worry about
it. Keep it down, Tom.
So, but, yeah, I have seen them. I haven't seen any recently, but I've seen them. I'm not a believer. I know they exist, and it's I think that it's kind of beyond belief that people would think that we are the only intelligent species in the universe, and that no other, that nothing else exists other than us. Yeah, I think it's beyond belief.
Well, I can hear the passion in your voice. What about you, Tom? Have you ever seen a real off-world craft of your own?
Well, I've had two sightings that I still can't identify. I don't know what they were, but they remain unidentified in my mind. The first one, I was in the Air Force, stationed at McClellan Air Force Base in Sacramento, California, about 1965. There was this large, white, completely circular something just hovering right over the base. If you took a silver dollar and held it at arm's length, it was about that size.
Wow.
White, just hanging over the base. And I'm sitting outside the barracks there waiting for a ride, and maybe 20 minutes the thing is just sitting up there, and I'm wondering, geez, doesn't anybody else see this? Am I the only one that sees it? I'm sure there's going to be some jets scrambled to go up and see what that thing is.
Yeah?
And nothing. So just about that time, after about 20 minutes, someone says, Tom, you have a phone call. So I go inside for about 10 seconds, 10 to 15 seconds, took a quick phone call. And when I came out, it was gone.
Wow.
Now, I'm thinking, if that's a balloon that burst, it should be on its way down, you know? I should be able to see it falling down. Well, there was nothing. If it was an aircraft of some sort, and it decided to move away, I should still be able to see it because it's only been a few seconds, but it was totally gone. I have no idea what that was, and to this day it remains, unidentified. The other one was a triangular-shaped craft I saw about 5 years ago. Flew right over my house. Maybe it knew I was working on Roswell. I don't know. But it was low enough that I should have been able to hear some engines or see some insignia or some markings that let me know that it was some sort of aircraft. But it was just a perfect triangle. Again, it was white in color and just flew silently over my house. It lasted about a minute. Don't know what that was. I still don't.
This was a daytime sighting?
Yes. Both of them were. Both were midday sightings.
Fascinating.
So
what about you, Don? Don, have you seen a off-world craft of your own?
I envy Tom because I think, like most people, we've seen lights in the sky. We've seen things that, at different times late at night have, you know, drawn our attention and made us ponder as far as the possibilities. But that's as much as I've ever seen. And I live out in the country. I'm out where, you know, there's just a tremendous star field every night that the clear skies, you know, part themselves and, you know, demonstrate just the wonderment and the possibility. And I think for having grown up in the country, one couldn't help but, you know, occasionally you question the possibility.
Bigfoot too, Don.
Not Bigfoot. But I wanted to at least follow up or, you know, make a comment regarding this very notion of the government after, you know, about 60 years. They're still protecting us. They're still trying to prevent mass panic in the streets and, you know, just wants to make sure that we don't have a repeat of the old War of the Worlds radio dramatization.
Well, just don't let Orson Welles announce the news and then you'll be all right.
Then we'll be all right. But I always have to remind people, especially the press, when they talk about this this idea that we can't handle it. We haven't matured enough. That maybe after all, we still need to grow further into, you know, such an announcement. Now, I always remind them that back in 1947, there was nothing in their field manual on how to deal with this. There
sure.
was nothing in the literature.
Oh, yeah.
There was nobody they could go to as to how to deal with this situation. And yet, there was no panic in the streets. There was no mass suicide. These people, they all worked their jobs. They went to church. They raised their families. They lived out their lives. And the difference is, we're only investigating it. We're only reading about it. We're only hearing about it. And they lived it. They were right there. They handled it.
And nobody lost their religion over it.
Of course not. And the point is, if they could handle it back then, that would be a tremendous blow towards humanity, the idea that after 60 years, we've now regressed to the point that we are no longer capable of even dealing with something that may indeed have been something off our very home planet.
Well,
we've grown up
with
Star Wars,
way.
Star Trek. We're all ready. We're all very ready for it.
The rancher Mac Brazel lived out in the middle of nowhere, didn't even have a phone. He had never heard of flying saucers, which were at that time just making their entrance onto the American scene. Never heard of those things. So they had no precedent to go by. The people that saw the bodies didn't call them aliens. They just, because that term was unknown to them in that context. They called them little people.
Little men, yeah.
Creatures, something like that. They didn't call them aliens or little green men. They just they called them little people for the most part. So it was
all
new
like you
to them.
I feel like you guys do that. We are much more prepared now to accept an event which many affectionately call global first contact. I think that's what Lyle was mentioning earlier. And Lyle, by the way, we really appreciate the call out there in Indianapolis.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on.
Bye.
You know, I've spoken to many UFO investigators, and some of them have seen, you know, UFOs, and some of them have not. And they're kind of going about it in a very systematic way. They're gathering evidence. They're making interviews, trying to get to the truth themselves. How did you gather evidence that what you were seeing, Tom, was actually not of this world? When you were looking at those craft, how did you make the decision that this was not something that's in the Air Force arsenal? It's not just some balloon that's shaped like that craft, you know, going over with the wind.
I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, well, this has got to be a balloon because it was circular, the one that was sitting overhead.
Uh-huh.
It's got to be a balloon because it's perfectly white and perfectly circular. That's the only thing of a physical craft that made sense to me because I was not aware, and I still don't think we have circular craft without some sort of other identifying markers. So when fighter jets or when no jets were scrambled, I thought, well, geez, the base must know what it is then, because they're not scrambling any jets. They must know what it is. But when I went in and took the phone call, and I'm gone for about 20 seconds, and it's absolutely gone when I return, then I started thinking, well, it couldn't have been a balloon, because the only way it could disappear is if it burst and fell to Earth, in which case I should still be able to see it descending.
Yeah.
But that didn't happen, and so I am left with the puzzlement of what could that have been. And as I speak to you, I have no idea what it could have been.
I was talking to not a witness, but a radar operator off, he was actually stationed in Alaska, and a naval vessel called in by Morse code and left a message that a craft had just come up out of the ocean. Now, this thing was about 70 feet across, and it came up out of the water, and the water fell off of the craft, and then it launched at about Mach 3 or Mach 4, straight up and out of sight. And so they Morse coded this in, and Dan Willis is the guy that that I was speaking to, and you may know his name. Not a witness, but he's the one that took that that Morse message from the ship out there.
Wow.
What do you think about the idea that there may be hundreds of thousands of off-world craft here on this planet, and they're not parked in Indianapolis? They might be parked under our own oceans.
That was one of the dilemmas that Dr. Hynek always wrestled with, the idea that we were dealing with a phenomenon that was actually traveling the, you know, the tremendous distances from, you know, star system to star system, that we have way too many reports. If we had, you know, one or two good sightings a year, that would be much more, you know, indicative of something coming from a great, you know, distance. But it clearly smacks, as you're alluding to, something much closer, something that indeed may have set up shop. And, you know, it's the very thing that we certainly would do. I'm surprised, and though if we have been continuing to go to the moon, I'm surprised that we haven't set up a lunar base. And I tend to believe that maybe at some point we did.
Well, it just seems kind of interesting that you have a Roswell crash and maybe a sister crash in San Augustine, and we'll talk about that when we come back after the top of the hour. And yet there, even if you remotely say that they came from the nearest star system, that's 40 light years. To make a trek like that, you'd have to bring some spare cans of peanut butter. I mean, you'd have to bring some kind of supplies. The fact that this was a fairly small craft, had multiple passengers, and there were not supplies scattered for 2 miles in every direction, because this craft would have had to have been 100 yards long to make a trek like that. Our rockets, just to get the fuel to get off of our planet, are almost 400 feet long. So it seems strange that just this small little short-range craft would smack into the ground in New Mexico without having some kind of local support.
Well, I think you have to make the assumption that they've solved time travel. That because everything you say is right. I mean, based on our technology, it would take eons to get to the next star, the next inhabitable planet, wherever that might be. But you have to assume that given the technology and the descriptions of the maneuvers and the things that they appear to be capable of, that they have solved what we would call time travel. That's the only thing I can think of.
See, we also have another theory, and New Mexico was the hotbed of all military activity back in 1947. And then 2 years before, with the first, I find it, you know, just so amusing that, especially, you know, lecturing on college campuses, that whenever you pose the question, not only to the faculty, but the students as well, as to where the first atomic bomb was detonated, invariably they always say Japan. And then when you correctly point out that, no, it happened right here in the good old U.S. of A., happened in New Mexico back in 1945, they all look a bit surprised. But that was precisely the case. But the point is, if, you know, I'm a vanguard, you know, or I'm, you know, of a higher race checking out the intelligence of this newly discovered species here on planet Earth, the first thing you check out is the military potential. You see if it's safe to land. You see if we can be even trusted as far as our initial reaction to, you know, such a landing. And enhance, they check out New Mexico, of all places, and then, you know, it only was a matter of time before one would actually crash. But the scenario is that first flash at Trinity in New Mexico is still traveling out through our own galaxy.
Sure.
An intelligent signal. It's a beacon. It's alerting anyone else who's out there that, wait a minute, those guys over there, third, you know, planet from the sun, you know, have some people that are experimenting with some, you know, really dangerous, you know, atomic energy. Well, needless to say, it's almost like a Starship Enterprise that is traveling through our galaxy, and it still takes them 2 years to get here. And in 1947, you have this tremendous wave, this arrival in the summer of 47. And according to Project Blue Book, where were most of the sightings back in the summer of 47? Well, New Mexico.
Interesting. Interesting.
So it all
we have to take a short break, and we will be back in about 4.5 minutes with more of Tom Carey and Don Schmidt. This is X Squared Radio. Don't go away, people. There's a lot more to come. Foundations of Religion and Science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared.
Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I need a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They've come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio.
This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Radio.
The spice is vital to space travel.
Where the past meets the future. Tonight, our guests, Tom Carey, Don Schmidt, authors of Witness to Roswell. We're talking about the book, The Case,
the expansion of your imagination to take in the idea that maybe, just maybe, we're being visited by beings from other worlds. In our last hour, we were talking about time travel. We kind of brushed into it because one of the realizations that was made when looking at the hard evidence of the Roswell case is that the craft was kind of small, especially for the number of beings that are alleged to be in the craft. It appears not to be capable of making the long trek across radioactive space for 4 or 10 or 20 or 40 years to get here. And I had broached the idea that perhaps there is an Earth base somewhere on the planet, and that maybe these weren't really long-distance craft. Maybe they were close-distance craft. But before we get into that, let me cover just a little bit of news. Memory made from tiny islands of semiconductors known as quantum dots could fill a gap left by today's computer memory, allowing storage that is fast as well as long-lasting. Researchers have shown that they can write information into quantum dot memory in just nanoseconds. Solid-state memory chips, as opposed to hard drives with moving parts, come in two forms. Computers are quick dynamic access memory, or DRAM for short, but data does not persist for long and must be refreshed over 100 times per second to maintain its memory. Flash memory, like that used in little memory cards and smaller iPods, is, despite the name, the elephant of solid memory. It can store data for years without refreshing, but writes information about 1,000 times slower than DRAM. Well, new research shows that memory-based quantum dots can provide the best of both, long-term storage and write speeds nearly as fast as DRAM, a tightly packed array of the tiny islands, each around 15 millionths of a meter across. That's called a nanometer. Could store 1 terabyte of data per square inch, researchers say. Pretty amazing stuff. If you think computers are small now, just wait. My guests tonight, Tom Carey and his co-author Donald Schmidt, their book is Witness to Roswell. Their website is roswellinvestigator.com. The Roswell crash is probably the best collection of eyewitnesses to hard evidence of contact with Earth by alien craft. Now, what I mean when I say that is most craft that people get to see are just like what we talked about in our first hour. Tom talked about a large white triangle or a large white disc in the sky. That's what we get to see. But in Roswell and even in San Augustine, something went wrong. Something unplanned happened to this craft, and it ended up smacking into the ground and got recovered. And they antiseptically cleaned the area, because I know, and I'm going to ask the question here in just a second, but I'm surmising that both Tom and Don have walked themselves over the site many, many times and have not really found any hard evidence. It's been cleaned. So how about it, Tom? Is the site clean, or is there still more to be found?
Well, you're right. Both Don and I have walked the site many times. Me in my desert boots and Don in his Gucci's. We've walked the site many times, and we keep hoping to trip over a piece that may have eroded out that they didn't clean up. But so far that has not happened. The thing is, Brooks, we've had two formal archaeological digs there. Actually, just one. The second one was abbreviated, and it was done for a short-lived TV show. Plus, there was one that was attempted in 1989 by QFOS, which was really not an organized dig. It was just, I would call it an ad hoc archaeological dig.
Well, we laid out we laid out a systematic grid. We mapped out the site. We used the theodolites. So we actually were just setting the groundwork for what then transpired years later, yes.
Good.
The I think Don will agree with me on this. If we are to find physical evidence at any of the sites, we have to look farther away from where the impact was and where the action took place, because they really cleaned those areas up. The pieces that we're going to find, if we are so lucky, will be perhaps miles away, certainly hundreds and hundreds of yards away, because they were very light and the winds are strong out there. And GIs being GIs, they're going to take the easiest path to finish their job and go back home. So we believe that certainly that, A, there are pieces still out there, but, B, they are far away from the actual sites themselves, which really makes it a needle in the haystack type situation.
Well, what about the idea that maybe this particular craft, the one that made contact with the Foster Farm in New Mexico, was not a long-distance craft, that it was perhaps terrestrial or even a close-by planet, like, say, Mars or the Moon as a base, to come here, that it wasn't a long-distance galactic craft? What about that that point of view? Does that hold any water?
Well, that is one of the reasons I cited the analogy of even a Starship Enterprise, that it was something from a mothership, that it was more of a scout craft.
Right, right.
And even as much debris which was scattered on the Foster Ranch that Major Jesse Marcel and others described as covering an area of almost a mile long by a few hundred feet wide.
Oh, my goodness.
The final impact site, which was another 30 miles to the east, southeast of that location, where the crew and the remains of a ship were recovered. That object was only about the size of a Volkswagen Beetle. It was more like a capsule, more of an escape pod.
I gotcha.
So you're absolutely correct. We're not talking about an object or even the materials described of the super strong yet paper-thin material and the I-beam structures that were pencil-thin and, again, paper-thin memory material at the debris field. We're not talking about something that appeared to be an interstellar, you know, spaceship of any sort. It clearly suggested something more remote, as far as more remote controlled, more of a scout craft, something that its performance, its duty was something more atmospheric, you know, that it performed right here within
sure.
our own earthly confines.
Right, something that was designed to
survey
to operate in our gravitational
data.
Field.
Yes, observational, right.
Right, right.
You know, Brooks, and now, speaking of the wreckage again, the light material, and it was, many, many, many small pieces at the Foster Ranch. We had an example in 2006. I think Don remembers this. We were shooting a show called Sci-Fi Investigates.
Right.
We were shooting the Roswell segment. And we were between takes, and a whirlwind came down, like a mini tornado.
Dust devil, yeah.
Dust devil, okay. It hit the table with the producer's notes on it, the pieces of paper, and it swirled up all of these pieces of paper into this funnel. And the papers just wound up flying thousands of feet away. They never did go get them because this dust devil took them so far. That's what happened, we believe, to some of the material. They just scooped it up and took it away by a natural force. And that's why we say that if we are going to find some material, it will be as a result of something like that. We were eyewitness to that. We just stood and
so we saw
with our mouths open watching this.
And it's one of the reasons that we also have the the ongoing.
And nobody was rolling film to see that happen?
Yes. And we've never seen it on film, but the way it mangled and twisted up the legs of a tent that the producers were under, and just the shock of, you know, the way it just...
I lost a good tent that way, too. How did that archaeological dig at the Foster Brazel Ranch site that was sponsored by the Sci-Fi Channel, how did that come about?
Well, Don and I, when we teamed up in May of 1998 to continue a proactive, and I emphasize proactive, investigation of the Roswell case. If you remember, 97 was the big 50th anniversary year, and
sure.
Media attention worldwide on the Roswell incident just was, it's sort of the peak was at its peak.
At a fever pitch, yeah.
Fever pitch. Well, after that died down, most of the investigators, the energy was gone. The energy to continue investigating was gone, but Don and I, we both, I was on the board at QFOS at the time, and Don came down from his home in Wisconsin to present some of the stuff that he was doing on the case. And after his presentation, this is a little, we still laugh about this, Don said, well, I'm going to New Mexico in 2 weeks. Does anybody want to come with me? And another QFOS board member, Don, says, how about you, so-and-so? And he said, it's 50-50. So hearing that, to me, that was a no. So I piped up. I said, I'll go. I'll go because I want to continue this. And so Don and I have been a team ever since.
Never look back. Yeah.
Never look back.
What role did you take in that when he said he wanted to go? What was your role in that research? Were you a tag along or did you bring something to the table?
Well, I had been a sort of an adjunct member of the Randall Schmidt team at that point for a number of years.
Since
91. So I was, familiar with the case and also with first-hand investigation. Brooks, we get a lot of people who say, boy, I really want to help you guys. I want to help you guys. So the minute we give them something to do, we never hear from them again. So,
gee, I have the same problem in my business.
I can clearly state that with Tom, it was a continuation as far as on the same theme, and that it was just basically picking up where we had left off, and now let's finish the job. Unlike the others who had essentially washed their hands of it, felt they had taken it as far as they could. And
yeah,
Tom and
sure.
I realized, as we have often stated, we were running a race with the Undertaker. And much to the chagrin of some of our colleagues who just, for whatever reason, still believe that there's nothing new to be gained by tracking down the remaining witnesses, we maintain that what better source for the truth on all this?
Sure.
Aside from the government itself, that until, and I tend to agree with your one caller that, we can wait for the rest of our lives and the government isn't going to come clean on this. So it's incumbent on us. And I think it's one of the reasons that we have been as successful as we have been, because if you're still out there, and if you still have some information, we may not find you tomorrow or even next year. But as long as you're still out there, we're going to find you someday, and we're going to come knocking.
It's kind of interesting. I got a couple of things that I want to throw in here, but I'm really curious about the Sci-Fi Investigates program in 2006, because I missed it. What was the result? What did they find in that dig?
Well, Just to preface that, Don and I, when we made our first trip as a team to New Mexico that May, we went to the University of New Mexico. That was on our first trip, as I recall it, and we met with the director of the University of New Mexico's Department of Contract Archaeology. They contract themselves out. Dick Chapman. Dr. Dick Chapman, and there we presented our case as to what we wanted done on the Foster Ranch. Now, we didn't know what to expect. We didn't know if they would laugh at us or throw us out or throw tomatoes at Don. I don't know. But they were very interested in it. They expressed they felt it was a story that was endemic to their state that needed an answer.
They
so that's how that
as an historic event. That's what was very gratifying at that stage. Yes.
Yeah, so I can imagine. And of course, there was the what-if factor. I'm sure they said to themselves, well, you know, maybe there is, maybe there isn't. But what if we do find something?
Yeah. But that was 1998, May of 1998. It took us an additional 4 years to find funding for such an undertaking. It was a formal archaeological dig overseen by the University of New Mexico. And it just happened, you know. And if you're out there and you're pushing buttons and you're shaking the tree, sometimes you come to something good. And the Sci-Fi Channel happened to be looking for a project at that time, and we were put in touch with the Sci-Fi Channel. Larry Landsman was the creative director for this, and we were put in touch with Larry. We all took another trip to New Mexico shortly thereafter, and he said, let's do it. So Don and I, we provided the witnesses, the site to be excavated. Most of what you saw on that show was provided by Don and myself.
Well, that
sounds
fascinating.
That was 2002.
I'm sorry, 2002, yes.
Right, so I believe me, I have a lot more empathy with this than you realize as trying to help an expedition take place to the North Pole. And I get a lot of people who say, oh, come on, it's not that hard to raise a couple of $1 million.
Let me
tell you something, people. That's 90% of the work is raising the funding. If you don't believe that, just do a little bit of history about a man named Christopher Columbus. It took him a long time to get that voyage funded.
Just to put it off from the dock, yes.
Yes,
you can't
undertake anything, and you can't say you're going to do something and get people all excited if you don't have the funding. I mean, we had a conference promised to us. They invited Don, myself, I think Stan Friedman was invited, a few others to this conference, and we're all set to go. We hadn't heard any more about it, and it turned out they couldn't get the funding for it. So you can't put having people making plans on your promises and then not have the funding to make it happen.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it takes a little bit of maturity, and of course we have seen, and you have seen as well, people jump out there, you know, if you build it, they will come. Well, that's not necessarily the case. You know, you have to have all the funding before you begin, or it's going to be a disaster. Now, I have lots of listeners who they want to know if the Sci-Fi Channel was really interested in trying to find the truth of Roswell or merely looking for low-cost content for their cable TV program. How were they to work with?
Back in 2002, when we were first contacted and asked if we could take the investigation to the next level, I think they were surprised that we actually had a scientific project in mind, and that being an archaeological dig. And when we actually went to New York and presented it to the higher-ups at the station, I don't think they realized that this was going to become their highest-rated, you know, documentary, highest-rated show in their 10-year history. So much for those who say that Roswell has become old hat and no one's no longer interested in it.
Exactly.
But we had to put this together in 2 months. I think that's what still amazes us, that Tom and I did it from thousands of miles away. And not only securing all of the permits and the Bureau of Land Management permits, the permissions from the ranch owners, but then also bringing in all the personnel, bringing in all the volunteers, the logistics of just putting together and bringing all the people together to conduct an archaeological dig in the high desert of New Mexico. You're talking about an area that the nearest hospital is 2 hours away. You're talking about an area that the ranch house itself on this respective ranch is 10 miles from this location. The nearest neighbors being 10 miles away. You're driving cross-country for over an hour through, you know, open high desert just to get to this particular location. And the wonderful thing about once it all, it actually took place, was about 3 days into the project, and we were riding back to Roswell from the site with Larry Landsman. And we asked him, we were talking about, we need to move more land. We need to actually excavate deeper. What can you do? Well, can we get a backhoe? Can we get a backhoe, a tractor with a backhoe shovel? And he gets right on the phone to New York, and basically, the boys want more equipment brought in. And within a few hours, we had the permission.
Wow.
So then, that is how we, Tom and I are convinced that, based on first-hand eyewitness testimony, that an object or a chunk of debris had skipped across the particular debris field area. And concentrating on that very location and using the backhoe that was digging cross-section through that area, and they discovered what we believe were the actual remnants of that gouge, that there was a symmetrical V below the surface of the ground. And for the first time, we had physical evidence that something had actually impacted with the ground at that very site. Now,
very
interesting. Didn't present us with any physical evidence of the ship, the debris itself, but it clearly ruled out a weather balloon, because there's absolutely no way a weather balloon would leave that fingerprint on that location.
Mm-hmm. So the officials with Sci-Fi or the channel, where they bought the time to run their program, no one tried to censure any of your material. You were able to bring out everything you found.
Well, you film more than is used.
Sure.
Don and I, of course, would have liked to see more of us on the show.
Yeah.
You know, we were certainly pleased with what they hired Brian Gumbel to be the host, who did a fabulous job. And the show, as Don said, it was the highest rated show in their history up until that time. Now, I think our show was sort of it appeared right before the Steven Spielberg Taken series came along, and I think they eclipsed us, but up until that point, our show was the highest rated show ever, and they have run it now for 6 years straight, several times a year. Dozens of times. They have made millions off of that show. So
yeah.
we have that from an inside source. They have made millions on that show, but we were happy that we were able to get some things done, and as Don said, we feel that we have found physical evidence in the form of that gouge that appeared when they brought in the backhoe.
Right.
They cut the earth at right angles like the layers of a layer cake, and you can see it there. Perfect.
Interesting. And I like the way that it was done. It was done systematically. It was done scientifically. And, you know, you say that it just took 2 months to pull all that together, but you guys had rehearsed this in your minds many, many times over the years, and so you were rehearsed and had the energy and the intention to bring all this to pass, and everyone felt that, and it worked, and it functioned, and you were able to pull it off. And for that, success or failure at finding physical evidence other than, you know, the actual impact site is absolutely phenomenal compared to many, many failed efforts to make similar investigations. Now, my listeners, they have access to me by email, too, and one is writing me and asking, what efforts have been made to petition the government to open the files, to open the warehouse, go dig out the crates that have the physical evidence, and let's bring it out. Who is suing through the Freedom of Information Act to get this out in the public?
Well, we could probably go back to even the mid-1960s with the late Senator / Brigadier General Barry Goldwater in his failed efforts. And as it turns out, and we even have a letter from Goldwater that it was the very base commander, Colonel William Blanchard, who would go on to become a four-star general at the Pentagon, who was a good friend of Goldwater's, who told him all about Roswell.
Really?
And that pretty much got him interested in this whole notion that, well, first of all, there was a massive cover-up, but that the physical proof may still be at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. So Goldwater, who then approached his good friend, the chair of the Joint Chiefs, Curtis LeMay, and asked him about, you know, actually seeing the physical proof, and was denied any access, and then he asked just to see even the files. He wanted to see the documentation. And Goldwater told us that it was the one and only time that LeMay ever cussed him out and told him, hell no, and don't ever ask me again. And Goldwater, who never really admitted this publicly, added one other caveat that LeMay himself added, and that was, and if you ever bring up the subject again, I will personally see that you're court-martialed.
Wow.
Now again, so much for something that, you know, according to the officials in the Air Force, doesn't exist. So then we bring it up.
It sounds like it's much more than a source of embarrassment for them. It's actually maybe somebody had a loose end somewhere and they needed to get the crates nailed shut after they got all the research done. They didn't want the light shined on that project just yet.
And there's that word control again. If they don't feel that they are in absolute control, that they resort to threats. They resort to smear tactics, discrediting of witnesses, and whatever it takes to, again, maintain that control.
Interesting.
I think the best recent example would be the late Congressman Stephen Schiff, who worked with us as far as disclosure on the Roswell case, and his petitioning to even then-Secretary of Defense Les Aspin for the release of the Roswell files, and then going to branch after branch of the military, through the Pentagon, through departments of intelligence, into the White House itself, and being stonewalled time and time again for any release of information. And Schiff himself accusing the Air Force of a massive ongoing cover-up. And then unfortunately meeting his own demise at the age of 51, dying of the skin cancer. So did he get too close? Well, we can only speculate. But there has been a concerted effort towards disclosure, even at the highest of levels. And our concern remains that the old order is not passing it down to the new, and that for whatever reason they've chosen to take it with them to their graves. And to me, that would be a travesty. That would be just a complete, you know, an utter, you know, tragedy as far as all of mankind. The idea that a few are speaking for all of us and are taking, again, you know, one of the biggest stories of all time with them to their very graves.
Well, that does seem like a travesty. And, you know, we have to think, the U.S. government, if you want to think we have a U.S. government or a single entity that lives and breathes as a single being, I don't personally believe that. I think we have lots of little bureaucracies trying to cover themselves and maintain their own budgets to do so. But what about other countries? What about, you know, in Mexico? What about the Russians? What about Germany? It's certainly been through its share of chaos. And even other third world countries, they have also come forward and said they're having a large amount of off-world activity in their skies. Are they performing the same kind of antiseptic gleaming of UFO sites and crashes?
Well, certainly some countries, I think France, Germany, maybe Great Britain, I don't know, they appear to be somewhat less stringent in their dealings with this sort of information. But in the Soviet Union, who knows? I mean, we've had Soviet people who have come forward and talked about UFOs and talked about the government's interest when after the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991.
Right.
But I think they take their lead informally. I say informally. I don't know if they have written codifications of how to handle this subject between countries, but I think they take their lead from the United States. And the United States still maintains that there are no such things as UFOs. And Bill Clinton himself, who we know for a fact, has a copy of our book. He was given a copy of our book by the Paul Davids, who wrote the introduction to our book, because Paul Davids' father was Bill Clinton's history professor at Georgetown.
How about that?
Yeah. So he personally handed Bill Clinton a copy of our book, which everybody has loved, and which you absolutely cannot come away with anything other than the opinion that, or the belief that a UFO did crash in 1947 near Roswell. You just can't come away with any other belief. And he asked the former president, will you read this? After introducing himself and who he was, he says, oh yes, I promise I will read it. Well, a few weeks ago, Clinton was made another statement. Someone had asked him a question about Roswell. This is just within the last few weeks. And
really?
Clinton said, well, I've read all the government papers on this, and I believe that it was not a UFO. It was a government project. Well, I'm thinking, well, he couldn't have read our book. He couldn't have read our book, so it made me, I think Don, when he heard the same story, I think Don sent an email off to Paul Davids, and I don't know where that stands now, but I was shocked to hear former President Clinton say that.
That does sound kind of surprising. Now, we're talking about physical contact between an off-world craft and this planet. What about the Barney Barnett site on the plains of San Augustine, the original body site in the Roswell incident? Is this part two of the same craft, or were these two different craft? Help us understand this.
Well, we're willing to believe, we're willing to accept that something did crash out in the plains of San Augustine or thereabouts, but that it was a totally unrelated incident. I know in the past when Stanton Friedman would present the scenario of the collision of two objects, and I would always kind of joke with Stan, you know, let's not make it ridiculous. We have to prove one first.
Right.
I think he's even backed off of that notion within recent years.
But, well, how was the San Augustine crash discovered?
Well, the story is that Barney Barnett, who was a civil engineer working for the state out of the Socorro Bureau office at that time, came back to work to the office one particular afternoon and mentioned, you know, the discovery of what attracted him, you know, off the road and then driving to the site, and appeared, you know, initially appearing as a downed aircraft, and then quickly seeing that it was a wingless, tailless object of some sort, and as he, you know, even got closer, noticed these smallish, these humanoid bodies that were scattered outside. And within a few minutes, an archaeological team would also arrive on the site, arrive on the location, and then within minutes, a military convoy would arrive to sequester them, secure the site, cordon off the area, and basically warn and threaten them into silence. And this was told to his boss, Fleck Danley. And Danley would tell us the story before he died, but could never really give us the year. And that Barney would tell him that it happened out on the flats, which was then interpreted to mean the very plains of San Augustine itself.
Right.
And then we would hear from his niece, Alice Knight, who repeated the same story. And the one person who really provided us with the most fascinating aspect of it was a neighbor by the name of Ray Baca, who described Barney's final time here on Earth with his throat cancer. And that Barney would attribute the cancer to getting too close to the bodies.
Wow. And
he thought that the throat cancer was a result of breathing near those bodies back in, around that time. So we've never been able to really pin down the year. We think we've been able to pin down the site. And Tom will get into that in a moment. But I think Tom and I have probably made as many trips to that area west of Socorro, New Mexico, as most anybody has. So we do remain open to the idea that something else may indeed have crashed out there. So, Tom, why don't you add a few insights?
As Don said, we are still, every time we go to New Mexico, the first day we spend on the Plains of San Augustine story. We've been out there. We've actually pinpointed the site from another, not eyewitness, but a fellow who, well, he may have been an eyewitness, but we have located the actual site. If I recall, I walked the site, as Don did, with a local historian in Socorro, and it was very windy that day, but we located it, and it's located about 12 miles southwest of the town of Magdalena, New Mexico, right on the edge of Highway, I think it's Highway 60,
yes.
Near the Plains of San Augustine, and nowhere near this site that they've been trying to push farther west near Horse Springs, there was a witness that alleged witness that came forward in 1999, I think, named Gerald Anderson, and we did a lot of research on his story, and we are satisfied that the story is a hoax. So to cut to the chase, we are still trying to find more information about the Plains of San Augustine alleged event. The main reason we are continuing is because everybody that knew Barney Barnett, the soil conservation engineer, says the same thing, that he was a straight arrow, that he would never lie, and that he would not have made up something like this. So I think for that reason, we are continuing to try to make progress on the Plains of San Augustine aspect. And as Don said, we do not believe it is associated with the Roswell crash, even though the 1980 book, The Roswell Incident, cited the Plains of San Augustine as the location where the Roswell craft finally ended up. But we don't believe that that's the case.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting that so many new pieces of evidence are still being sought out. And, you know, one might think, oh, gee, this was on national television and everyone knew about it, you know, since the early 60s. Not really true, because in Kentucky and Tennessee, for instance, they didn't get cable TV till the late 80s. It just didn't come along. There wasn't enough population.
The first appearance, every time you say someone comes along and say, oh no, it happened back in 1492. There was somebody beat the drums and it's talked about Roswell. But, in 1980, there was a show called The In Search Of. It was a half-hour show, and Leonard Nimoy, the Dr. Spock of Star Trek fame, had this show, this half-hour show, In Search Of.
Right, right.
And one episode was about the Roswell case, and they had Jesse Marcel on. And I believe that was the first TV exposure of the of this particular case.
Right, so it was way late. I mean, like 30-something years after it occurred.
Yes, it was another 9 years before anything else was on about the case, and it was on the Unsolved Mystery Show with Robert Stack. Remember that
show? Right.
And Don, I think, will agree with me. It was that show that really, I won't say jump-started the modern interest, the latest interest in the case, but it was one of the two things. The other thing, I think, was Don and Kevin Randall's book. But the Unsolved Mystery Show, was they devoted a large segment of their 1989 inaugural show to the Roswell incident. And as you recall, at the end of each segment, they say, if you have any information regarding this this particular segment, please call the station, email or whatever. And that particular show generated a lot of new witnesses to the case. Is that correct, Don?
Absolutely. In fact, you're absolutely correct in your assessment, Tom, that that was a jump start, September of 1989. And the producers at NBC, I mean, you're talking, it was a primetime, highly rated show. And as a result, we literally received dozens of new leads regarding the case. And it became a springboard.
This was when my co-author, her pen name is E.J. Clark, she saw that show, or at least
yes.
a rerun. It was in the late 80s, 89, maybe it was even 1990.
September of 89, yes.
And she said, you know, gee, Roswell, New Mexico, wait a minute, 1947, I was there. And she called up her brother, who's a little bit younger than she is, but has an immaculate memory. And he said, yeah, we were in the car with Mom and Dad, and we were, in those days, cars didn't have air conditioning, and they traveled kind of slowly, and it was in the summertime, so people travel at night across the desert.
You're right
so
about that.
So there's a little caravan of two or three cars, and they're going from a city south of there through, now there were no interstates back then, so these were all two-lane roads, and they're tooling along at a top speed of 40 miles an hour, and overhead, this tremendous flash in the sky. It just lights up the road. I mean, in these days, you're talking 6-volt systems in cars. So lights didn't go out very far in front of the cars. The cars pull over to the side of the road. All the parents and all the kids pile out of the car, and they go, gee, what was that? And they talk about, well, maybe it was a meteor. Maybe it was a fireball. There was not a cloud in the sky. And that's how she remembers that event happening, and maybe her witnessing of that crash.
Well, I interviewed her this week.
Yeah, tell me how that went.
Well, very nice lady. I think we spent about an hour on the phone, and her story is just as you related. And she says that they looked up and that it apparently happened over, you know, pretty straight up in the sky from where they were standing. They had
right.
stopped the car and gotten out, and her brother claims to have seen a craft. There was this crash and this bright explosion. And her brother, she says her brother said that before this happened, he saw that one was a craft. One continued on, she said, to the north, saying today that that was probably the one that crashed near Roswell. Then the other one, she said, headed towards what would be the plains of San Augustine. The problem with this story, and I'm not saying anything I didn't tell her.
No, that's okay.
The problem that I have with her story is that she pinpointed the date as June the 20th. Now, I asked her how she was able to pinpoint the date, and she said, well, there was no moon in the sky. She remembers there was no moon in the sky, so they got out there charts for 1947, and and tracing back from they were headed towards Florida, I believe, and tracing back from where they were and what day it was, she thinks that they were in New Mexico, and there was no moon. She said that would make it June the 20th. So I told her, I said, our investigation, it's not just our investigation, but everyone who has investigated the Roswell case, the multiple investigations, we all will agree, based on testimony, logistics, documentation, that the crash occurred somewhere between July 2nd and July the 4th. That's what if you ask any Roswell investigator, they will give you a date that's within those parameters. And
is it possible that maybe the moon had not risen yet? Maybe it was earlier in the evening when this occurred, on the 2nd or the 3rd or the 4th.
Well,
you know,
she,
I don't
she
think
was sure that it was a moonlit night. There was no moon. So, going with that, she was pretty positive that this occurred on June the 20th, which, for the reasons that I just stated, we would have a difficult problem aligning her event with the Roswell incident. But
I can
understand why. That's just our opinion right now. Things are like, who knows. But that I only interviewed her for the first time this week, so
right.
One can also accept that as a witness, tries to ascertain, and in cooperating with investigators, specificity as far as when something actually occurred, are going to do all in their power to try to come up with that information, and so
sure.
In trying to retrace and actually chart through astronomical lunar mappings at that time, it's hardly the manner by which one would actually determine when something happened. Just because they didn't see the moon at that particular time, well, then we derive that it happened on June 20th. Well, I would suggest that we could provide some latitude as to, within a week or two when this may have occurred. And just to disqualify said witness is because they provide a date that doesn't match, our own determination. We shouldn't rush to judgment at this time.
Yeah,
well,
and I don't know too many 8- or 9-year-olds that could remember if there was a moon on a particular night or not. I mean, you can go back as an adult and say, no, I don't remember a moon, so that had to be about this date. And she didn't know enough about the case to even, set a date that correlated with other witnesses. So she did the best she could. But it's interesting, the other parts to her story, maybe not the date exactly, but the fact that this is what they saw. Now, it lends some credibility that perhaps this was a very high altitude event because they didn't hear anything, not even a sonic boom. And one has to ask the question, how fast would craft have to be traveling to crash so far apart, so closely together? I mean, within seconds of each other.
And as
the
late Jesse Marcel, accepting that this was a mid-air explosion, that this wasn't, a result of an impact, that this was indeed, a mid-air, disaster, before raining down pieces of material through central New Mexico.
She told me that she was south of Roswell when this happened. That was the other thing. She was south of Roswell. They were heading from California to, I believe, Florida, or an eastern state. So that was puzzling to me, that she was south of Florida and saw this. And the other
south
thing,
of Roswell.
South of Roswell, yeah. The other thing is that Don and I do not believe that the Roswell crash resulted from a mid-air collision.
Yeah, I kind of find that hard to believe, too, that one could traverse space and time, as it appears, and not be able to negotiate a fairly thin atmosphere and avoid hitting each other.
We have it from first-hand witnesses that there was a severe thunder and lightning storm the evening of July the 3rd, 1947, up near Corona.
Right.
And we have witnesses that heard the explosion, the muffled explosion, as they describe it, of something other that was not one of the thunderclaps, something between the thunderclaps that sounded like a muffled explosion. We have a woman who actually heard the device over her ranch house that night. It was circling for about 10 minutes. She said it sounded like a broken lawnmower. It just was circling her house. And then it went off, and then she heard an explosion. And this is the evening of July the 3rd.
And we should point out the way that she was able, or the way that we had helped her determine that it was the evening of the 3rd, her husband, they were putting fence posts in for the ranches in that area, leading up to that 4th of July weekend.
And they were
heading home for that holiday weekend, and that they would have finished their work that July 3rd. So that's how we arrived as far as that date.
And also the fact that her husband was, well, shall we say, he was sleeping heavily from drink that night. and she said that he never drank on nights where he worked the next day, which meant to her that he wasn't working the next day, which would have been July the 4th.
I see.
So
we do have another caller on the line, so hang on just a second, guys, while we honor this caller. Your first name and where you're calling from, please. We have a caller on the line. First name and where you're calling from. Nope, I guess we lost the caller. Okay, let's continue with the story.
But that's how we piece together events. The anchor for the Roswell story is the July 8th headline in the newspaper, because that's when the story was reported nationally, and a lot of witnesses placed their activities by the day they saw that headline, which was July the 8th. So we do have a few, what would you call them, datum points that we use as anchors. And in some of the newspaper articles, it quoted the sheriff of Roswell, George Wilcox, as saying that the rancher, Mac Brazel, found the stuff a few days before. And this is before the 8th of July, which would, a few days before the 8th of July is, to me, 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, I would say so, just a few days.
Yeah.
I think we have that caller back now. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please. Oh, I'm sorry, that caller hung up again. Well, we're having a great time. Why don't we go ahead and take the break at the top of the hour? We got about three and a half minutes of break. And we'll be back after a couple of short messages here. Please don't go away. Just hang in there, and we'll get you on. If you're calling in, we'll make sure to get you on the air. All right. So hang in there, and we'll get to you. Just don't go away. All right. Here we go. Thank you. friends down at NRG Resources have introduced a new engine oil technology. TVT 24/7 is the future of lubrication. This is the industry's first environmentally friendly oil additive that not only increases fuel mileage, it reduces engine, gearbox, and transaxle wear to nothing. The other brands fail anti-friction testing in less than 10 minutes under standard testing conditions. TBT 24/7 went more than 24 hours in the test and still did not fail. Get tomorrow's technology today by visiting the online store at X Squared Radio and pick up TBT 24/7 Engine Oil Energizer. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. We're glad you're back with X Squared Radio.
Life extends life.
We're in our third year.
Life expands consciousness.
Continuing to grow.
Despite the advice to space travel.
They're still holding that 50% per quarter growth rate. And it's because of high quality guests like the ones we have tonight. We have Tom Carey and Don Schmidt with us, authors of Witness to Roswell. And their website is RoswellInvestigator.com. We suggest you get there tonight, or if you're sitting in front of your favorite workstation on Monday morning, just cruise on over to RoswellInvestigator.com, pick up that book. It's very, very good read. Excellent, excellent amount of data and information. It's not sensationalized. You'll come away from that more than a believer. You'll have knowledge.
Could I add, Brooks, that our book has become an international bestseller, and your listeners can pick it up also at your local Barnes & Noble and Borders.
So where would they go to get a signed copy? Would it still have to come through your website?
Don?
Through the website. In fact, we're actually going to be setting up another website for that sole purpose. So for the time being, yes, through the site mentioned, but we're going to be setting up a separate so people can actually get personalized autographed copies of the book. That should be coming up very shortly.
That's what it takes. Real enthusiasts in this industry, we really like to have those autographed copies, because when you have two investigators of the stature of these two men who have gone, as you have already heard in the first 2 hours of this three-hour program, they have continued to make the trips back out into the high desert of New Mexico when other people would say, oh, gee, that's an old story. We need to go on to something else. There's lots of information still to go on this. And as long as we believe we can hold the line and we can hold the pressure against those who are withholding this evidence from us, eventually, like the FBI, these two investigators will get their man.
Well, that's very kind of you, Brooks, really.
Well, you know, it's funny. We live in a very strange kind of 24-hour cable news society. And when the camera battery lights wear down, the story's over. I mean, we're ready to move on to the next soundbite. But when it comes to true investigation, whether it's a serial killer, a bomber, a rapist, someone who absconds with government secrets, eventually, they're going to make a mistake. Eventually, one lawsuit is going to make it. Someone is going to run for office that walks into that little bureaucracy somewhere in Ohio or somewhere in Maryland and walks in upon this evidence and says, holy cow, this is what we've been looking for 50 years. I'm going to share it with the public because they need to know. And it's because of the pressure and the integrity of these two men that it will happen. I believe that.
Well, again, thank you from both of us.
I'm not going to give away the store here, but Don and I are hoping that this is going to happen from result of our investigation this year.
Well,
we believe that before the year is out, that we have our best opportunity this year to get ultimate proof.
We have an opportunity, and we are grateful that we happen to be the ones who are hopefully there to grab that brass ring. And as we have often said, if we succeed, if we win, then we all win. And it's
well,
never
let me
been...
ask you, in our third hour, we go well beyond what most talk radio programs go. We try to get well out there on the edge of what you really are trying to say, and not just in your book, but the notes that you have right now that haven't even been typed up. We want the latest, greatest zeal that you can apply to this. And that's why people come here, because they listen to the kind of publicity wings of the federal government, and a lot of these AM stations and FM stations, they're owned by very few, advertising conglomerates, and so they kind of have to say what they're, taught to say. And there are those of us that think there's some kind of social preparation going on by the media, which is ostensibly owned by a few publicity wings of the federal government, to get the world ready for some kind of revelation by the government. Now, what would you say to leaders to calm their fears that that we're doing a dress rehearsal for interplanetary war.
Wow. I believe, number one, we are ready. It's not the 1938 War of the Worlds where New Jersey rioted in the streets over a radio show. There have been, you know, a number of movies that have been very good that treated the aliens, the alien presence, as non-threatening. And, you know, cable TV.
A la Close Encounters of the Third Kind,
yes.
You know. Spielberg's early work, not his later work, which just scares the hell out of people.
Which one was that?
Well, War of the Worlds.
Well,
is that Spielberg?
Yeah.
The Close Encounters I was thinking of.
Well, Tom, I don't even know if you know about this. In the next Indiana Jones, there is an entire scene referencing Roswell and the Roswell debris evidence.
Oh, that's interesting. Interesting. So the Secrets of the Crystal Skull is going to have a piece on Roswell.
You know,
piece on Roswell.
When I heard that Steven Spielberg was going to do another Indiana Jones movie, and Don knows this, we had been planning a screenplay, an Indiana Jones type screenplay, because Indiana Jones is an archaeologist, of course. And the legend of Roswell is that the craft was initially found by a group of archaeologists. So we were planning an Indiana Jones screenplay around the Roswell incident featuring Indiana Jones. And when I heard that he was doing another Indiana Jones, I said, oh, please don't let it be Roswell. Don't let it be Roswell. And then I heard what Don said also, is that there is a reference to Roswell in this latest Indiana Jones movie.
Well, it's interesting. There's another independent filmmaker who is well known in the digital effects business. He owns a company called Florida Effects and also Jaguar Films in Florida. And he has shot a digital movie based on Zachariah Sitchin's work.
Mm-hmm.
And this first one's called One Anunnaki. And it's been shot. All the backgrounds are done. It's in musical score right now, and it's very close to being released. And there are millions of people waiting for this story to be told. So there's a lot of preparation going on. But my overall question is, do you think the government, a la nightly Fox News UFO updates, is preparing the general public for their idea that we need a new enemy that we need to gear up for, and so we can't be cutting our defense budget now? Is there any truth to this? Do you get any kind of feeling for this?
I personally believed at the time that NASA released information just a few years ago about this meteor that contained fossilized microorganisms, suggesting indeed that there was life elsewhere beyond
our
planet. That was a very innocuous, very safe way of first testing the waters, testing the public reaction. We're not alone. There is possible life elsewhere. And if we all remember, there was utter fascination. There was not the slightest hint of fear or concern from anyone that I was aware of. And I think we all passed with flying colors. And
I think
beyond
so too.
That, I have always liked to believe that if indeed relics, artifacts, any remnants of a advanced or former civilization or any life on Mars would be proven, that too would be very safe, very unthreatening, non-threatening, as far as suggesting that, well, even our nearest neighbor may have had life at one time. And then that would lead to the next stage, the actual admission that not only have we been visited, but we have the physical evidence, vis-a-vis Roswell. So And I know it's been speculated that even Steven Spielberg in his earlier movies, that this was part of this conditioning, part of this education. And that may have stemmed, you mentioned, as far as some of the earlier reports, some of the tests suggesting that, are we ready? Are Earthlings prepared for this reality? But you have to take it to the ultimate extreme. The very idea that we are being, that there is a threat, that it, there is a threat off the planet, would be such an extreme that I don't know how we would make that quantum leap at the point that they're not even acknowledging that anything is out there, let alone that there is, and it happens to be a threat. So I don't know how we would...
Okay, they're not admitting to the general public that anything is out there. But let me tell you, as a former Air Force alum, if there was a craft out there that could walk away from an F-15 like a AAA fueler does from a Toyota Prius, they would be very interested in doing all the research they could do to find out if that's real or not. And if it's real, they want to know what it is that powers it. They want to know, how does it make those kinds of maneuvers, and how do we get our hands on it?
No question.
And if it is capable of doing trans-dimensional shifts where they can move across vast distances of space and even time, they would be even more interested in that.
And we know that they certainly were post-World War II, post-Roswell 1947. We know for a fact that they were experimenting with ESP and remote viewing shortly thereafter, all suggesting that their minds had been opened, that there had been an epiphany as to, my God, there are other levels of intelligence and potentially other dimensions that we're first discovering. And that's one of the reasons we believe that Roswell has always placed us in that driver's seat, even on a global level. As
right.
Tom suggested earlier, that the other countries follow our lead regarding the topic.
What it boils down to is a question for the general public, for religious leaders, for government leaders, for people listening tonight and tomorrow. Are these beings that are visiting our planet friendly, or are they potentially an enemy? That's what question people ask themselves when they think about this. Do we have to face an Independence Day, or do we have to face a close encounter of the third kind sort of alien? And are they really aliens? Are they settled here and have been here for hundreds of thousands of years, living, you know, clandestinely under the seas of our world, and maybe even inside our world, coming out from time to time to monitor things? These are questions people ask on this program all the time.
Well, I know I don't want to, you know, hoard the microphone at the moment. I want to let Tom chime in, but I just wanted to cite one other theory that we've often entertained, especially indeed if any evidence of any advanced civilization still exists on the planet Mars, and that asteroid belt that separates, that is between the Earth and Mars, if indeed there was a planet at one time, and whatever caused that planet to disintegrate may have at one point had a devastating effect on the climate, on the very life on Mars. And was there an evacuation? Was there an attempt to possibly evacuate right here to planet, our own planet Earth?
Right.
And for that very fact, they can't, you know, just walk our streets and pass themselves off as just the new neighbors down the block. They set up underwater bases, underground bases, and as they are typically described today as being very pale, very ashen-skinned, and very large eyed, suggesting a subterranean culture of sorts. So I know what this hour is about, and it's the type of thing that even Dr. Hynek, in his final years, we would sit in for hours, just speculate and theorize and just, you know, what if this and what about that? And it's amazing how many different solutions or potential solutions one comes up with when they just allow themselves to step out of the box once in a while.
Well, and we run into not so public evidence here. We interviewed an engineer off the record and off the air who hired an individual who was a former POW in Russia. He was actually in a gulag in Russia. And now this man is 6'4", and when he came out of the gulag, he weighed 90 pounds. So, and it gets you an idea how emaciated he was, but he also proved himself as a survivor. And when he came to this country, he learned how to deep sea dive, and he became a salvage operator off the coast of New York. And after World War II, there were so many scuttled German U-boats and so much junk iron on the bottom of the ocean outside the Hudson Bay from World War II that he made a really good living. And his wife ran the ship while he dove on the bottom and connected up cables while they hauled all this iron to the surface and scrapped it out. One day he goes over the side with the cable down to the bottom. He has about 1 hour of air, and he doesn't come up for 6 hours. Now, there's a massive rescue effort going, but there are not that many deep sea divers. Nobody's going down 200 feet to find this man. She's just making funeral arrangements in her mind, and then up he comes, climbs over the side, and he's only used 15 minutes of his air. So besides her being just beside herself with joy to see him and also confusion, you know, you've been gone for 6 hours. I know how much air you take down with you. Where have you been? And he relays the story of how he saw a shape in the murkiness near the bottom, and he dragged the cable over there. And the next thing you know, he falls face down in the mud inside an air bubble that's being maintained under the water. When he lifts up his face and peels his mask off down there, he sees a flying saucer. So these beings come out and telepathically communicate with him, sort of like a la The Abyss, but this takes place in the early 60s. Here was this craft, and they took him inside and they showed him how it was driven and all that, and then he put his gear back on and went back to the surface. This engineer relays this story of a former employee that he had that was this diver. So there's lots of evidence, lots of eyewitness evidence out there that there are craft on this world, and they may have been here for a long, long time, maybe longer than modern man. This is a paradise in 25,000 light years of space. Of that, there's no denial. So it isn't outlandish that we're attractive to visitors.
Well, I will say this. Carl Sagan, the famous Cornell astronomer, the late Carl Sagan, often said that, and by the way, he was no UFO buff or believer of UFOs, that the UFOs were visiting Earth, but he's believed that there were at least a million evolved, and he used the term evolved, intelligences in the Milky Way galaxy alone. Now, the Milky Way is one of hundreds of billions of galaxies in the universe. And in just one galaxy, ours, he believed that there were at least a million evolved intelligences. Now, who knows what the local features are on the planets where these intelligences evolved. But you would have to assume that not every one looked like us. Not everyone would look like people of Earth. So the fact that there are various descriptions of the entities that people have claimed to have witnessed, it doesn't surprise me, given the vastness of the universe and the different evolutionary paths that maybe 100 a million in the our galaxy has chosen. But the most often reported entity is what was described at Roswell, the diminutive, frail little creature with long arms and a big head and almond-shaped eyes, et cetera, et cetera. But I think my own view is that the government is not preparing us, is that they're still trying to keep the secret, but that more and more information is being developed in the private sector from people like Don and myself, from other investigators, and that if you watch, what are the most popular topics on TV during sweeps weeks? It's UFOs and sharks, right? So the public is interested in it, and there's information there, and right now, on cable TV, at least, there has been an explosion of these paranormal-type shows. Ghost hunters, UFO hunters, Destination Truth, and things like that on the cable channels. They must be putting those on TV because there is a desire to have that sort of information to be seen.
Well, there's also a desire to put them on the air because of the incredible success of a show called MythBusters. So, you know, they're trying to follow that motif.
Yeah, it's a reality-based show, and it's what has been dubbed paranormal, I guess. But those types of themes resonate in the general population. So I think it's my own view is that because in academia the subject of UFOs is poison. In politics the subject is poison. It's still poison, and in my view it stems from the 1950s when after the initial wave from 1947 to 52 died down, you had these people called contactees that claimed to have been taken aboard these Venusian scout ships to Venus and the Moon and Mars. And I think we're still suffering from those types of claims from the mid-50s, the contactee stories. And it gave UFOs a bad name. It's still with us. And the subject, I'm sorry to say, is still poison to certainly academia and politics. Look what happened to Dennis Kucinich when they made fun of him when he mentioned the story about seeing a UFO a few years ago. Instead of treating it seriously, they made a joke out of it.
Even Jimmy Carter, same thing. It seems like the best evidence, the best story that has the most witnesses, the most hard evidence, the most contact record is the Roswell story. And your book describes many new military witnesses to the recovery operation. So let's name a few of these. Who is Earl Fulford?
Well, Earl Fulford is a first-hand witness to... he was on the team that went to the Foster Ranch to help clean up the debris. He's 82 years old as we speak. He's still alive. And we found him he didn't come forward. We found him. He was just a name in a yearbook that we dialed up one day, and we just happened to catch him at the right time. He had never told his family. His family had wanted him to speak for years, and I guess the stars were right that night when I called him, but he decided to talk. And his story is that he was grabbed one day with a bunch of other airmen on the base, and they were driven out about 2 hours out into the desert north of Roswell and driven to this ranch, and they were told, to use his words, to pick up anything that wasn't natural and put into a burlap gunny sack. Pick up anything that wasn't natural. Now, Fulford told me that his feeling was that his group was not the first group that had been there because he could see previous tire tracks, and there wasn't much wreckage at that point left. And after the spending the day there, they had filled just a few gunny sacks handful of small scraps of metal that the other crews hadn't gotten. But he described them, you know, the memory metal, the famous piece of metal that you can wad up in your hand till it feels like nothing, and then place it over a flat surface, and it smooths out like glass. You can't cut it, burn it, or scratch it.
Wow.
That's what Don and I call the Holy Grail of Roswell. We're looking for a piece.
And nobody put a piece of it in their pocket in a little wooden box on their mantle and said, I'll wait a few years till the hubbub dies down.
Well, you don't know how close to the truth you are. But that's what he described. And so when they were done, they had to, you know, turn in their gunny sacks, which were emptied into a wheelbarrow. They were driven back to the base, and each man was debriefed, told never to speak about where they were. As a matter of fact, they never had been there, was the story that they were supposed to go with. And that was that until a day later that, I'm sorry, this would be a day before this happened. He happened to be leaving his shift. About 4 o'clock, he worked in a hangar. He was leaving his shift, and he sees this 18-wheeler lowboy coming on the base. It's got something under a tarpaulin in the on the truck bed, about the size of a Volkswagen. He told me was under. He never did get to see what was under it, but whatever was under there was about the size and shape of a Volkswagen Beetle. He knew the truck driver as a fellow who worked in his squadron, and so he waved his arm for the truck to stop, and he knew the fellow, and he said, "Hey, George, what you got under there?" And he says, "Well, first he says, where you been?" He says, "Oh, up north of town." What you got under there? "Well, I can't tell you. They told me I can't say anything." And so he says, with that, he puts it in gear and drives it into the base hangar where we know that the recovery operation took place. And the driver of the truck is still alive, by the way. He's 88 years old. He hasn't denied the story. He just maintains that he can't remember it. So that's one way that generation tells us that I don't want to lie to you, but I'm not going to tell you what you want. I'll just tell you that I can't remember. So that's what they do.
You know, there's not much fear that you can strike in the heart of an 82-year-old man. You're just not going to intimidate them anymore. And
right.
A lot of these guys only served one tour, and then they were back out in the private sector. So
yes.
maybe if he can't remember, but...
I can tell you, Brooks, from experience, and Don knows this, that the higher the rank, the less likely the person will talk. From conducting hundreds of interviews of these veterans, the higher the rank, the less likelihood it is that they will talk. And also, a career military man, there's less likely that a careerist will talk than somebody like Earl Fulford, who was not a career military man. I think he spent 8 or 12 years in, and then he got out. He was not career. The more likely they will talk, and that's been holding up pretty well during the entire course of our investigation. So,
What about Eli Benjamin? Is he still around?
He's still with us. He was a private first class with the 390th. Station at Roswell at that time. He had a top security clearance, and he was assigned to guard that very hangar that Tom just mentioned, P3, which is now known as Building 84. And because that was the central hangar of operation where they took the ships, the bodies, the debris, he was assigned to a duty squadron that then transferred a number of gurneys with bodies over to the base hospital, which is just to the west of where that particular hangar is located. And it was there that they observed for the first time that there was indeed a survivor, that there was a live one. So
wow.
Benjamin would be our first true witness to an actual survivor of the crash. And the first time that Tom and I actually talked with him, as he actually just bridged, you know, that admission that he had seen not only bodies, but he had seen a live one, he became very emotional. He actually started to weep at that point. And his wife would even describe to us, you know, shortly thereafter, that they had really been unable to sleep in the same bed for almost 30 years because he still has nightmares. He still will bolt up in bed during the middle of the night because he can't get that image. He can't get those faces out of his mind.
Now,
we're talking about one of the best actors we've ever seen.
Do you think there was some kind of communication between the live one and Eli, or do you think it was just the thought that he had recovered something people should know about, or the fact that maybe this live being wasn't going to survive the night, and it wasn't from his injuries, but rather a desire by those who were going to end up with the bodies that that those beings would not survive?
So again, we're talking about, you know, the very personnel, the very men and women who had just survived World War II, had seen the worst horrors, you know,
sure,
you know, that man could possibly observe.
The greatest generation, sure.
Something that surpassed that. Tom and I have often, like the late General Arthur Exon, when he would describe some of the experiences during World War II, and they would become very emotional. I think any one of us, in talking with people from that generation, their memories are still that vivid, that real. And this was, again, something that even surpassed that. We had a description from one of the officers that very first evening when they returned back to the base after the recovery operation had commenced. And he said as you walked past the barracks, you either heard men praying the rosary or weeping out loud.
Sure.
This was, again, something so unprecedented. So I think exactly as it had to have that type of impact with Eli Benjamin, that it was such a shock, and it may have been such a shock to their own existence, their own, you know, state, you know, in, you know, their place here on planet Earth, and where it went from there, that we can only try to comprehend what thoughts went through their minds at that time. And I think it's one of the reasons that Tom and I have truly developed such a respect beyond even World War II. The fact that they dealt with this. They dealt with this firsthand. And they want the truth to come out. I mean, we hear this over and over again, but they still feel, you know, that pressure. They still have that reluctance because of their risk of loss of pension and possible
sure.
imprisonment. They're concerned for the safety of their loved ones. So, again, so much for this just being a weather balloon.
Huh, right. Now, who are the paper boys? Are they still around?
Yes, the paper boys, these were fellows who would go into the Roswell Daily Record, one of two local daily newspapers in Roswell, and the Roswell Daily Record was the afternoon paper, with the Morning Dispatch being the morning paper. Well, we tracked down a half a dozen paper boys who recall that they had just gone in around 3:15 to the newspaper to get their daily supply of records to sell on the street, and which would put them on the street around 3:30. And so they're selling their papers out there, and lo and behold, here comes this convoy right down Main Street, which is the Main Street in Roswell. It's called Main Street. This 18-wheeler lowboy with something underneath a tarpaulin, a tarp that it was carrying, about the size and shape of a large egg, or as they said, a size of a Volkswagen Beetle. Where have we heard that before? So we interviewed each one of them, and they all told their experience in seeing this convoy, the 18-wheeler surrounded by, oh, maybe a half a dozen Jeeps, some in front, some in back, some alongside, each carrying MPs with armed submachine guns. Right.
Well, now you don't see that in you know, rolling down the streets of Roswell, probably before or since.
Right, and that's exactly how they put it. I asked them, I said, did you ever see this before? No. Did you ever see it since? No. And what caught your eye about this? Well, it was the convoy, but then their eyes focused on what was on the truck. And there was something under there, and one fellow thought he saw the tarp flap back for a second where he could see silvery-type wreckage. That's how he described it, silvery-type wreckage. And on to the base it went. We had another fellow who was a roofer. This is at the same time. He's putting a roof on a house south of, on the south end of town where the base is. And he also described this convoy, surrounded by Jeeps with machine gun bearing MPs, and into the base it went. And that's where the Fulford story picks it up. Fulford picks it up, Earl Fulford, when it got inside the base and he saw the truck heading towards the hangar, P3, as Don described, and he stopped and he asked the driver, who he knew, what do you got there? So that's just one, and we know, so that's how we pinpoint, Brooks, that's how we pinpoint when this craft came to the base. We know that this was on Tuesday, July the 8th, because it was the day that the big headline came out. Air Force recovers flying saucer on base near Roswell. So we know that the date and the time that this escape capsule or pod or whatever that thing was that withstood the explosion over the Foster Ranch and continued on for another 30 miles when it came to rest, we know when that was brought into town, and it was on July the 8th, about 4 o'clock. So that's just one little vignette as to how we find a datum point that we can anchor, other activities too. So that's how we do it.
Well, it definitely sounds like you've done the investigation. You've put together multiple eyewitnesses who have not previously corroborated their stories. They viewed the same episode from different vantage points. And you hunted them out one by one, and you got their testimony. Now, in your book, you present another smoking gun with documentation from a Major Patrick Saunders. Now, without giving away everything in your book, what did he provide you?
Tom, you go ahead, because you were the one who came up with it. So,
Patrick Saunders was the base adjutant. He was a major. Patrick Saunders, his picture's on the page that has all the main officers of the Roswell Army Airfield back in 47. And Don was working with Kevin on the case, they interviewed Saunders back in the early 90s, and Saunders told them, he laughed about it. Oh, you guys are after little green men, ha, 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 nothing happened. Basically, that's what he said. Well, in 1994, Don and Kevin wrote The Truth About the UFO Crash at Roswell, their second Roswell book, the first one coming out in 1991, UFO Crash at Roswell. Well, apparently Saunders, who died a year later in 1995, he gathered up a nice stockpile of The Truth About the UFO Crash at Roswell. And contrary to what he told Kevin and Don a few years earlier, he wrote an inscription on the inside page that described how the Roswell crash was covered up. It's the first page inside the book, and it's called Damage Control. And he wrote above that little passage that described how they did the cover-up. Here's the truth, and I still haven't told anybody yet. Pat. And he sent that around to friends and family. And a copy of it made its way to Randall and Schmidt. And by that time, he had passed away. But what he was signing on to was the procedure that was put into place to cover up the Roswell story, and that he was actively involved in it. His daughter was interviewed by Kevin or Don, I don't know which one it was, was interviewed by Kevin, and he told Kevin that she told Kevin that her father had told him that he was proud of the job that he did covering up the Roswell case. That they first thought it was a Russian device, but then they realized that they were faced with technology that was far above what we had, and that they were wondering what their, meaning the UFO occupants, what their intentions were. And that was the fear back in 1947. But the smoking gun is that there was a cover-up in place almost immediately upon the securing of this craft and its crew. A cover-up was put into place. It's still in place today, even though there are, even though it's leaking like a sieve.
Well, sooner or later, and we have it from Tom Carey and Don Schmidt tonight, that this year they expect the archives to be opened, the barn doors to be unlocked. And
we expect to open them.
You
expect to open them. Yes.
Well, let me make an open invitation to you, because this program, we have top priority on hard evidence. You don't have to go through a producer. You don't have to find an inside contact person to get a free 5 minutes on this program. We will set aside whatever we are doing to bring this story forward. So as soon as you get the lock cut off the door, shoot us a piece of video or call us up on your cell phone, and we'll put you live, or we'll do a recording while you're on site, and we'll put it immediately on the net radio, because we're on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week here at X Squared Radio. And that's
we are not going to call Geraldo on this.
I'll pick you up on that, Brooks.
We've had enough people withholding evidence for maximum profitability. This is a time of full disclosure, and we want to know. And so that invitation is open to you too, anytime.
Well, we're both excited about this.
Let me interject something at this point for any of your listeners who still they think to themselves that this was some type of top-secret project. You know, even a mogul balloon is the third official explanation. Even as we've been able to pin down the dates that Mac Brazel, the rancher, first discovered the debris field, that early morning, we believe, was July 3rd, Thursday morning, July 3rd.
Uh-huh.
No, excuse me, Friday morning, July 4th, excuse me.
Friday morning, July 4th, right?
Friday morning, July 4th, and he still finishes up. He's the ranch foreman. He's the supervisor. He's working the ranch all by himself at that particular time, and it isn't until he completes his weekly chores that he finally makes the 75-mile trek down to Roswell on Sunday, July 6th. Now, the material is interesting enough that the base commander himself, Colonel William Blanchard, doesn't just send a couple grunts out, a couple of MPs to go check it out. He sends out his two very head of intelligence, Major Jesse Marcel of the 509th, and the head of counterintelligence, Captain Sheridan Cavett, in case it's something foreign. And because Cavett, at that time, you know, he specialized in foreign technology. So They arrive on the scene on Monday, July 7th. The military already has the material in hand the day before. They put the press release out on Tuesday, July 8th, 2 days after they've had the material in hand. So much for a rush to judgment. Washington, and we can demonstrate it, was completely involved in the whole orchestration of that press release, actually announcing the recovery of the flying saucer. But the point here is, all those who still believe that this was something top secret, they've never been to New Mexico, they've never been to the high desert of New Mexico, and first of all, Tom and I, who have been in small planes, who have been in helicopters over the area, one of the things that comes quickly to point, quickly to note, is that the moment you are airborne, you see that from horizon to horizon, you can literally see for 100 miles. It is just so totally unobscured. It's, again, high desert, wide open pasture, wide open range. And the point is that was that material was out there for 3 to 4 days before the military arrived on the scene. And if nobody was looking for it, then it wasn't ours. And if it wasn't ours, then whose was it?
That's exactly right. If it was a top-secret operation, they would have been there within an hour.
They would have found it before the rancher did.
Exactly. Exactly. Excellent. Excellent. All right, my friends, we are out of time for this episode. 3 hours goes so fast on this program. But I do want to make sure that you know that invitation is open. My guests tonight, Tom Carey, Don Schmidt, authors of Witness to Roswell. Their website is RoswellInvestigator.com. So please, when you're listening to this tomorrow or the next day at your workstation, go to their website, check it out, pick up the book. Don, Tom, thank you so much for coming on the program tonight. That's why we're here.
Our pleasure.
Our pleasure. And we'll be back. We'll be back.
All right. Excellent. Thank you very much and good night.
Bye.
It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.